Today I'm interviewing two 2016 Franklin High School graduates who are also graduating from Western Carolina University's Master's in Public Administration program in a few weeks. Eric Mendez and Matt Wilson came back onto my radar after writing columns on racism for Western North Carolina publications and have included their columns in the show notes. The penetrating incisiveness of their writing, their clarity, their call to action pierce the fog of the op-ed page. We discussed their time in Macon County schools as it relates to race. We talked about their plans to possibly work in the triad area in municipal and county government and what has shaped their respective philosophies. And then we broached the hot topic of the moment, critical race theory. And if you want to jump ahead, that's around the 27-minute marker. When I spoke to Eric and Matt, I felt good about the future. They're so sharp, reflective, caring, humble, and compassionate. The mountains can be harsh. The mountains can be loving. But in either case, wisdom is always imparted if we listen. And I hope you enjoy the show. This is John DeVille, and I am the Mountain Philosopher. In today's episode, confronting racism in our daily lives, our schools, and through local government, a conversation with Eric Mendez and Matt Wilson. So today I am joined. I can't remember. Did I have one or both of you?
You certainly had me.
Okay, yeah. And Eric. Okay, I have two former students today. What years did y'all graduate, Matt?
2016.
2016. Okay, and Eric.
2016 as well.
2016. Okay, because I tell people this all the time. I can remember who a student taught in 1988. I can remember where they sat. I cannot remember who I taught last semester, nor their names. So I've got some decent long-term memory, but the short-term memory is not so swift. So two 2016 Franklin High School graduates who were both in the Master's in Public Administration program at Western Carolina, and so that's a two-year program. So y'all are about ready to – you're 6 weeks away from – having your MPA wings and going off into the world and doing all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Yeah. Well, Matt, I'll start with you, and then we'll just take the same questions back and forth here. How did you get into the MPA program? What made you decide? What did you do your undergraduate work in?
My undergraduate work was in political science. I also minored in sociology. So I've always been really interested in the political process itself, and I was very interested in finding a way into the governmental process itself within Western North Carolina. So that was basically my main focal point, trying to get into the MPA program.
And Eric, what about you?
Well, mine was kind of a different journey. So back in high school, I remember I hated politics, absolutely hated it. And it was a long journey. I started off in psychology for undergrad and then switched to sociology because just psychology wasn't working out for me. But it wasn't until I met one of my professors that convinced me to do a minor in political science, which I fought her against, but ultimately she won in the end. And I took a political science course, and then I started to realize, like, wow, this is really interesting, and it caught my focus. And then I realized that I could do so much to help out the community, specifically the Latinx community, through a political science major. So I switched to political science. And then at first I wanted to do political activist work, but then I was also caught by the attention of local government and how I can make a strong impact on the community through that. And that kind of led me into a MPA program degree.
Yeah, he saw how much fun I was having.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Eric, what exactly was it that the professor told you that closed the deal for you to go into political science?
Well, it was actually a conversation we had on civil rights, and it was through the civil rights movement. And then I began to see how through public policy, through the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the entire political process behind that, it really just motivated me, and being able to see little bits and segments that they introduced us of, like John Oliver, Stephen Colbert, all of that. And it really just motivated me and inspired me. Like I could do something with my MPA degree and hopefully become a role model to many other Latinx members, specifically within Western North Carolina.
So two white guys who are, one's a talk show, well, two talk show hosts who have comedic backgrounds, that's what convinced you to go and go after, well, that's one of the parts that convinced you to go after an MPA.
Ultimately, one of the parts. And then just through all the history lessons that I've learned and an introduction through so many other great writers and speakers that I never read before, Angela Davis, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., actually being able to thoroughly invest myself into this and read their works. That's what really inspired me that I could do a lot more through political science as my major. And then ultimately, that trailed off into wanting to go into an MPA.
All right. So you've name checked a lot of African-American civil rights leaders. Is there a particular Latinx thinker, writer, activist that moved you?
Absolutely. So one of my biggest influences is definitely Cesar Chavez and his movement for the farm workers. His movement just also really inspired me, as well as sociologist Dr. Eduardo da Silva, Bonilla Silva. He was such an amazing writer, and he's also what inspired me to do my more research on color blindness, because he was the one that kind of wrote the ideology of colorblind racism. And he was one of my biggest influences. I almost had the opportunity to meet him in person back in 2020, but unfortunately, due to the pandemic, that kind of fell out.
Matt, I promise I'm going to come back to you. One last question here of Eric. What's colorblindness?
Right. So colorblindness is the ideology that if we don't see race or we don't acknowledge race, then racism can't thrive or can't exist. And that really comes from from Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. In his speech, he had a quote that I might be misremembering the exact quote, but it was that one day he may not be judged by the color of his skin, but by the content of his character. And that really resonated a lot with white individuals, because they wanted to, it presented an ideology of a very quick and easy solution to a very complicated problem. And that problem being racism and racial tensions during the civil rights era.
So there's nothing wrong with color blindness. It's just that to think that the problem was solved in 1963, before the end of the poll tax, before the Voting Rights Act of 65, before the Civil Rights Act of 64, before the Civil Rights Act of 68, and all the work that still be done, that to be white and to latch onto that and act as if that there's no work to be done, that the end of the dream is already here, is not correct.
Yeah, so that pretty much sums up the idea as to why so many people approach the concept of color blindness, and why they always argue that I don't see color, or I don't see race. I teach my children not to see race. I don't care if you're black, white, purple, polka dotted, whatever. I judge people based on the content of the character. And while that does have its like it comes across as polite and it has its good intentions, it goes about it the wrong way and being blind and ignorant towards racial disparities and the racial tensions that currently are happening. Because what we have to understand is that we have to accept the fact that racism hasn't gone away. Rather, it's adapted to its times. So it's not going to be as in your face and as blatant as it was during the 1964 era, during the civil rights movement, where black peaceful protesters were attacked by police dogs or hosed down violently. That no longer is going to, we can't really see that in today's time. It masks itself in being completely ignorant and I'm trying to form my words here.
Well, would you say that the racism that exists in 2022 as compared to, say, the mid-1960s is more invisible, it's below the surface, it's systemic rather than overtly obvious?
It's definitely more systemic. We're seeing it through policy. For example, one of the books that we read in our MPA courses was The Color of Law. And there it's talking about the idea of gentrification, of redlining, and how those laws are still, some of them are still in effect today, and how those laws that were maybe installed 50 years ago have tremendous impact on the communities of color and minorities today, and how we're still feeling those effects for generations to come.
We're going to let Eric take a smoke break, I'll turn to you and ask you the same general question. You can riff on particular writers, thinkers, activists. Who in the intellectual pantheon has been influential in your thinking and in what you might want to do in your first job or two as somebody who's carrying an MPA from Western Carolina?
I don't believe I would categorize him as being a member of the intellectual pantheon, as you put it. But Eric often riffs against me for using him as an inspiration. But growing up in Georgia, in rural Georgia, I always took Jimmy Carter as an inspiration for me and his dedication to public service, not just in his time in the Georgia legislature or his, presidency, but also his post-presidency and his dedication to truly serving the people and going back to his home of Plains and traveling across the globe, helping stop diseases and helping build houses for the underprivileged throughout society. He has truly been one of the greatest inspirations that I have had, at least in my childhood. And what I would like to do is to try and at least emulate that to some respect, whether that be through my time in local government, whether I take on politics in the future, or whether I just, go into teaching as you do, teaching at a community college, possibly.
You don't want to teach high school?
I mean, I've been to three different high schools over the course of my public education, and I have to say it's not something that appeals to me, teaching high schoolers.
All right, I'm going to push you one little more, because I'm curious, what's the big community college is hunky-dory, you want to do that, but not the year before.
What, in terms of why community colleges?
Why community? I mean, because you're there's definitely a gravitational pull for community college, and there seems to be some sort of I don't think so when it comes to high schools.
Right. Well, I sort of see it through my own lens. I grew up in a very privileged household, and community colleges weren't necessarily something that was looked upon as the next step after high school. But thankfully, after moving here. We downsized after the Great Recession, and we had to live within our means, and community college was just the most practicable step for me after my high school education. It saved me a lot of money. I think I became a better person and a better student because of that experience, and being able to provide to students who are in that position, who do go through that pathway, is something that I would like to help contribute to and help them benefit from.
What do you think you got at your first 2 years of community college as opposed to going to a four-year school for your first 2 years?
Well, I think it provided me with a greater sense of community. I think it's a much more tight-knit group of students and faculty members that you are seeing day after day. I think it presented me with a better opportunity to really take some time to ascertain what exactly I was to do. I know I wanted to help benefit the community, leave my mark on the world, so to speak. But it really did allow me the time to formulate what exactly that looked like. And so I think that was the main draw of it for me.
All right, Eric, what do you want to do with your MPA? What do you want to do?
Well, short term, I really want to be able to kind of learn of the intricacies of another profound or newfound passion that I've recently discovered of budgeting. One of the main things that you learn in local government is how intricately embedded the budgeting process is with every single aspect of policy and service provisions provided to the general public. And so it's definitely a newfound passion that I want to pursue. And ultimately, the long-term goal being to earn the position and the title of a city or town manager and taking the time to also teach. Whether or not that's going to be at a high school or a community college, I haven't decided yet. I'm open to all possibilities.
So when we say budgeting, we're talking a city budget, not a county budget, not a state budget.
Correct.
Do you how closely do you follow the budgeting of the town of Franklin?
For the town of Franklin, not as closely as I should. Recently, I did relocate, so I've been more focused on Asheville and Buncombe County's budget process, as well as Guilford County, another county that I'm currently applying to. So those are the budgets that I've been primarily focusing on.
And when you examine those budgets, whether it's Asheville City, Buncombe County, Greensboro, Guilford County, what is it that you see them doing that, okay, yep, they've got their game together, they're doing the right thing, they're budgeting where the policy needs are, and if you had been hired, I mean, this is your interview question right here, how would you, what kind of a budget, different kind of budget, would you be suggesting to the city council or to the county commissioners?
Great question, because one of the things that really interested me was with Guilford County, their budgeting process, they actually have this practice of participatory budgeting, where every year they take $500,000 from the city's budget, and they're able then to use that in dividing it up into $100,000 per district for the city of Greensboro. And residents of the city can then decide on what they want that extra funding to go towards. So if they want, for example, a community garden project, if they want to invest in a new building, they would have a say in where they want that money to go towards. And that's something that I'm a strong advocate for, is being able to allow the citizens to have a larger say and being more engaged within the budgeting process for their communities.
Matt, Eric's going to go off and be a budget guru. What are you going to do? What do you want to do?
No, it's very much the same pathway. I think as you've probably noticed since our middle undergraduate years, we're very much in sync when it comes to our career aspirations. So I also am very much interested in going into the budgeting profession for local government. And, you know, hopefully through, you know, progressively gaining additional responsibilities and potential leadership opportunities, eventually becoming a county manager myself, as opposed to Eric, who seems to be more akin or desirous of having a municipal manager position. So that's currently where I think I want to take my MPA.
If you have followed the, and I'll start with Matt, then we'll go to Eric. Same question for both of you. If you followed North Carolina's budgeting for the past at least decade, at least since January of 2011, but this also happened under Democratic-controlled General Assemblies as well, the rise of the so-called unfunded mandate, there are actually two problems. There's the role, the rise of the unfunded mandate, which is the state telling the 100 North Carolina counties, you have to do this, but then the state not funding it. That's an unfunded mandate. And then there is kind of like a backdoor unfunded mandate. It was something that the state used to fund. It's been policy law for a long time, but the state is not quite kicking in the same amount of coin that they used to, and counties are under more and more pressure to raise property taxes. Counties really, from what I can tell in watching this stuff for like 27 years, counties, you know, can raise property taxes, they can levy a sales tax, and that's about it. Those are the only two tricks they've got up their sleeves to raise revenue. So have you paid attention to that particular process, to the lack of funds that are coming from the General Assembly and the pressures that are put on counties? Is there anything of particular note that you've noticed that you'd like to comment on?
Not in particular with regard to the unfunded mandates set either by the state or by the federal government. I do know that within Western North Carolina, for example, I think like a lot of individuals within the community like to present this notion that local governments and the people who operate within them are essentially making bank off of the individual residents of the community. And that's not necessarily true at all. As you well know, a lot of these taxes are going to straight back into the community. They're going straight back into service delivery. That's transportation, that's capital planning, that's administration, you name it. These are all funds that are going directly back into the community itself. But yes, it does add an additional strain to the local governments themselves when they have these additional regulations placed upon them by the state and federal government.
Eric's been keeping up with Buncombe and Guilford. Do you have a couple of counties that you have vicariously adopted in terms of keeping up with what their budget situations are?
Well, I had my previous internship experience with Jackson County, and I do not keep up with them probably as much as I should. It's a community that I have a lot of affinity for. I care a lot about it. It's where I was born. I don't have a lot of connection to it, but it really resonates with me. One thing I have noticed with their ARPA funds that they have received is that they are utilizing those funds to go to body cameras for their police officers throughout the community to help better transparency and just ensure that, you know, for the safety of the police officers and the individuals they encounter within the community, that everything is, you know, on the up and up, so to speak. But not necessarily at the county level. Currently, I'm working with the city of Asheville, and one project that I am taking part in is trying to incorporate matters of a racial equity toolkit into their capital budgeting process. And so we are currently taking three pilot projects to utilize this toolkit on and basically assess what the racial disparities are, if at all, on some of these projects that have been laid out before us. And the idea is to try and, take lessons learned from that and be able to expand it to other aspects of the organization of the city of Asheville.
So what would I do if I'm on the Asheville City Council, if I'm the Asheville city manager, or I'm an Asheville city employee that has some impact on policy execution, how would I end up using this racial toolkit exactly?
So yeah, absolutely. Say like you're a department head, for example, with community and economic development, and you have this project to help expand this greenway, for example. Well, I actually formulated this racial equity toolkit, which has been adopted by the city of Seattle and the city of Madison, Wisconsin, all of whom base their racial equity toolkits on what's called the GARE model, which is the Government Alliance on Race and Equity. And so in order for a department head to basically utilize this toolkit, they would just submit a CIP request form. And based on that information, they would take...
What's a CIP request form?
Oh, it's just a cap capital improvement plan. Yeah, I'm sorry for the acronym, but they would just submit that form, and in an addendum to that, they would submit the toolkit, and that would go through like, what department are you from? What funds are you drawing these funds from? And then going into forcing department heads to ask these internal questions, like who is impacted by this? What data are you utilizing? How do you assess what are some unforeseen consequences of this project? So really forcing individuals within the organization itself to not only focus on the positive aspects of a project, but really contemplating what exactly could go wrong. What are some unanticipated consequences? Like if we revitalize this structure within downtown, what does that do to the infrastructure if we have heightened tourism down in that part of town? Does that price out individuals within the community who may be disproportionately people of color? So really just getting at the heart of those questions is basically what this toolkit is for.
That's all pretty fascinating, because if there's any one single Achilles heel of progressivism that I can put my finger on, it is the failure to consider unintended consequences, to get all caught up in the virtue of the moment, the virtue of the project, and not think about how it all might play out. Okay, well, that is a very good first half. I think we'll take a break, and we'll come back with Matt and Eric here in just a second. Okay, we are back with Matt and Eric, and during the break, I said, well, guys, what do you want to talk about? And Eric said, let's keep it boring, and let's definitely do critical race theory. I'm going to let Eric define it, because he's probably read a heck of a lot more about critical race theory than I have, but I would argue to all the listeners, and I would suggest that they go look at the campaign of Glenn Youngkin in Virginia, the successful campaign there, that ginning up fear around critical race theory is quite apparently an effective political tool. Fear is always good. It might not be constructive, but it's indeed powerful. And we're seeing it in Virginia. We saw it in Virginia. We are seeing Republican candidates across the country. School board races, county commission races, races for the General Assembly, races for the House of Representatives, Senate races. Critical race theory is becoming a topic of discussion, a wedge issue that's utilized in these campaigns. So, Eric, I'll start with you. What the heck is critical race theory, and why are you interested in looking at critical race theory?
Right. So critical race theory, by definition, is an academic concept that's been around for more than 40 years. So it emerged out of a framework of legal analysis during the late 1970s. So the core idea of this theory is that race is a social construct, and that racism is merely the product of individual biases and prejudice, but also something embedded within our legal system and policies. So in other words, critical race theory is an academic study at the undergraduate and graduate level that aims to examine the role of racism in the modern era in ways that, it's become woven into our social fabric.
Okay, I'm going to push you to unpack two words, woven into and embedded. What do you mean that racism is woven into the fabric of American culture? What does it mean that racism is embedded into the substrate of American culture? And what are the consequences for that wovenness and that embeddedness?
Right. So what I mean by woven into our social culture is I mean that racism has transformed itself to become more systemic within itself. So an example of that would be ethnic sounding names. So I know that kind of sounds crazy right off the bat, but in a national study by the National Bureau of Economic Research, it was confirmed that people with more ethnic sounding names are less likely to get interviewed when applying for jobs. So applicants with white sounding names were about 33% more likely to receive callbacks for interviews. And this study actually was quoted saying that having a more quote-unquote white-sounding name was the equivalent of having 8 years of additional experience. So it's more than just assuming people shouldn't care about color or names. Companies, governments, and schools should take the biases out of hiring. And it starts to unpack a bigger situation here of how racism is embedded within our hiring process, its system, our policies, and even through processes like applying for houses and so forth.
Okay, Matt, I'll go to you. Here's your chance. I have critical race theory on the tee, on home plate. Here's your big baseball bat. What about critical race theory? Do you have anything to add or maybe disagree with what Eric had to say?
No, nothing directly to contradict anything that Eric said, but I wanted to emphasize both for, you know, yourself and your viewers that us discussing these topics, us broaching these topics about critical race theory and racism in and of themselves do not necessarily equate us to be standard bearers of liberalism, if you will. The reason why I wrote my guest column in the Franklin Press discussing critical race theory and, frankly, its absence within Macon County schools and North Carolina public schools is simply to state a fact that these teachings are not being taught within our public schools. It's not a political statement to say that the sky is blue. And I do not consider discussions surrounding race to be a political discussion. It's a moral one. And it's something that we always must fight against, both within, you know, our personal lives, within our businesses, and within local government and just government generally. We must do our best to mitigate biases wherever we may find them. And it is not a political discussion or process in order to try and mitigate those.
I'm going to bring you squarely back into the DeVille classroom and try to make you squirm uncomfortably. I don't know how you can talk about critical race theory and not say that it is just overtly political. You use the word moral, you use the word fight, you talk about mitigation. How are those activities inherently not political?
Well, no, you are correct in saying that they get driven into political discussions and that present society is very much our present society's politics is as centered around race as they were back in the civil rights movement. There is no question about that. However, I personally believe that discussions around race and discussions surrounding mitigating racism should not be political. That is my personal opinion. But however, you know, the powers that be, if you will, try to make it political and try to drive wedges within members, within community members, and drive us against each other in these discussions.
And just to connect the last couple of dots there, why are they doing what they're doing?
Because I think they see a political gain from it. I think they see an end by doing that, by leveraging fear, by leveraging misinformation against individuals that simply do not know, who do not have these intimate experiences or knowledge about what is going on in our public schools or have a lot of relations with the African-American community or the Latin community. And so in order in within that vacuum, a lot of these political actors, they intend to inject this misinformation into these people's lives and drive their decision making and their attitudes toward certain concepts and, frankly, certain other people. And so that is why I believe they are doing it, is because they see a way to gain power. So, yes, to answer your question.
Eric, same question. Is it political? And I'll go ahead. We've wrung everything out of the cloth that we can wring right there. If you want, you can go ahead and jump to the next question, which is, you're a recent graduate of Franklin High School. Let me ask you this question first. I did work with NAACP out of Jackson and Haywood County the past couple of years on some anti-racist workshops for teachers in Macon, Haywood, I think they'd in Jackson, and I think maybe also in Swain. And one of the things that I think the group undertook was to poll recent graduates of the area schools. As a graduate of Macon County Schools, both of you graduates of Macon County Schools, but I'll start with Eric here. Is there anything particular, Eric, as a person of color, but just in general, and Matt, you can riff on this too, is there any particular things that you saw coming out of students' mouth, administrators' mouths, teachers' mouths that you don't think should have been coming out of their mouth?
Definitely. So one of the biggest things that I was talking to Matthew about in a previous conversation was the fact that a lot of times when we do talk about, for example, critical race theory, there are parents that just don't want to have the uncomfortable talk about race to their own children. However, being a person of color and growing up in a more rural white neighborhood, I experienced racism before I even understood the concept of racism. I was verbally called the N-word by a former classmate of mine in an elementary school. I had no idea what that was. I then had a very uncomfortable but meaningful conversation with my own father, who had to sit me down and then explain to me what racism was and that there were going to be people that would just not like me due to the color of my skin. I then raised the question of children of color and families of color have been having these uncomfortable discussions with their children for generations. How is it fair that children of color would have to experience racism before they even understand the concept, but we seem to give leeway or leniency towards our white counterparts because they don't know any better? They never understood the concept of racism.
I'll piggyback on that right there. It's seemingly okay, although of course if it was a poll question, it wouldn't be answered this way, but it's seemingly okay for a child of color to be uncomfortable because of racist sentiments uttered by classmates or other people in the school environment. But we don't dare make white kids uncomfortable talking about how kids of color are uncomfortable.
Absolutely. And it also further manifests itself in just microaggressions that you experience on a day-to-day basis. I remember working at a Starbucks once, and just the microaggressions you experience when you get an order wrong and you're then put on blast and you write an article in the Franklin Press, and rather than people taking to account what it is that you're saying, you're just going to be bombarded with emails regarding the authenticity of your citizenship, the legitimacy of whether or not you can even vote in the state. And it does get a bit frustrating, but it's a fight nonetheless.
Let's go to your columns that you wrote. I found two that you wrote and one that Matt wrote. Can you give us a brief synopsis of the one that you wrote that generated the most vitriol in terms of response?
Right. So that would have to have been my first article that I wrote. And my intention behind why I wrote the article was during the height of 2020 and the Black Lives Matter movement, I felt compelled to want to write an article discussing what racism is itself. And there I talked about how racism isn't as in your face or as blatant as it once was. It's changed. It's altered itself to be color blindness. And even bringing up examples of how there has been a spike in hate crimes against Asian Americans due to COVID-19. That I received the most hate from, specifically because nobody really cared about what I had to say. Rather, they just saw my last name and bombarded me with emails of, if you don't like it here, go back to Mexico.
Where's your evidence that they're reacting to a Z at the end of your last name as opposed to some other part of the content?
Well, previously, I also wrote an article about a certain congressman, hint, hint. And that one did not include a photo of myself at all. There, I was also bombarded with racist comments on the Smoky Mountain News. There was no photo attached to it, but just my last name. And I requested for the comment section to be taken down because I didn't want to see that. I didn't want my family to see that either.
Matt, I'll go to you. Racist sentiments, racist interactions that you saw as a student of Macon County Schools.
Yeah, and just for a bit of context, I think I can give a little bit of a different perspective than what Eric provided. I've been to three different high schools, two of which were located in a predominantly white, affluent suburban county within northern Georgia. And so coming to Macon County, it wasn't until I had moved to Macon County where I experienced amongst kids my age within classes that I attended that where there was a certain casualness with which racial epithets were uttered. So Beaner was used as an example, and I did hear the N-word used as well. And you always see almost like a double take that your fellow white counterparts sort of take to make sure like we're amongst, you know, whites within this conversation. It's like an exclusive club almost before these racial epithets are uttered. So in terms of those utterances, thankfully, I did not experience or hear of any utterances like that from any faculty member or teacher. But certainly it was eye-opening and shocking for me to experience that coming from where I had been in coming to Macon County Schools.
So one last question to close it out here, and again, staying within the school environment. What needs to be taught? What needs to be discussed at length, and how should it be discussed when it comes to issues of race or anything else that you think that we're missing in the social sciences? And Matt, I'll start with you. What do we, you know, if you're going to write a study or you're going to write, if you're going to write a letter to Macon County Schools, what would you have to say is, you know, hey, you know, I had a great time and, you know, all these things worked well, but this left something to be desired, and I think you ought to address these things and in this particular way.
No, certainly. You know, high school is a very unique experience, and for me, getting the experience from three different high schools was particularly unique. But if I had to write a letter of sorts to Macon County Schools administrators, I guess the one thing, or perhaps several things, I would recommend to help them address future generations of Macon County citizens is to just be more open and transparent with basically getting at what I was discussing in the guest column, discussions surrounding race, racism, topics of sex, sexuality, you know, difficult domestic situations within the home as they relate to domestic violence, matters of finance, like building a credit score, helping you look for a job, like what do you want to specialize in, and not necessarily just trying to help feed you into a four-year institution. So really just discussions surrounding these very important topics and these very uncomfortable subjects that I think students need to be subjected to if they are going to be able to be self-sufficient, thriving adults out in the world. you know, we often get into a discussion about a brain drain effect that manifests within rural communities such as ours within Western North Carolina. And a lot of these kids aren't going to stick around here. And they are going to be confronted with a lot of situations, a lot of different circumstances that they are simply not going to be prepared for because they were sheltered so closely, both by their administrators in their school systems and by their parents in some instances, or legal guardians. And so that would be my message to them, is to just be more open, be more upfront. These kids can handle it. They can handle mature conversations as adults can. You just need to have trust that they can handle them, and you give them the guidance and they will flourish, essentially.
I think so. I think all beautifully said. Eric, you're writing your letter to the Macon County School Board and to the Central Office Administration. Well, what's in your letter?
I would have to kind of take more of an approach towards the parents in this situation, specifically circling back to the concept of critical race theory and this mass hysteria to try to have legislation passed to have this banned within public schools where it's not being taught. But I see it as posing a huge danger when it comes to just these vague and broad definitions within these state legislation bills that are being passed as to what constitutes as critical race theory. Because if you can't define what critical race theory actually is, then you can't really identify something that you don't know anything about. So then that line is kind of blurred as to what actually constitutes as critical race theory. And then in lessons of slavery, eugenics, parents could recognize that as critical race theory and then call on a complete ban of discussing those subjects within their own children's education. How will we learn about racism, the way it manifests itself, and the way it's embedded into our system and our public policies if we don't have those discussions because we are too afraid and we make these subject matters too taboo to talk about?
Again, beautifully said. Thank you. I want to thank Eric and Matt both for joining me this evening to discuss these tough issues, to discuss their future plans, their education, their experiences in Macon County schools. And it's really hard for me to believe that they have been out of school for 6 years and have, it's not that they hadn't grown here as high school students, but the maturity, the clarity, the coherence, the awareness, the largeness of the heart, the capacity to work towards systemic change, to getting at root causes. This was a great way to end a goofy day. So I want to thank both of you for stopping by and sharing your stories, your experiences, and your plans.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
Mm-hmm.